Night Hops podcast is intended for you, but not your children. My dad and Matt say bad words in this episode, which isn't good for kids like me to hear. Listener discretion is advised.
As I am rolling.
I too am rolling.
This way we can get both of us to bed at a decent hour. Because we are the Night Hops and we do things late at night.
All right, episode 109?
Long past 109.
You know why I always think it's episode 109? Because Bill and Ted is episode 108, and for some reason there's a glitch in my echo. And so the podcast is my alarm, and it is stuck on the Bill and Ted episode.
Oh.
And we talk about it being episode 108 at the beginning of it.
Well, we fucked up then, because episode 106 is Bill and Ted, and episode 108 is Life Force, which is a Monstoberfest episode that people should check out.
We didn't slate yet. You don't have to plug episodes.
Shit.
What episode was it?
We are on episode 138.
Episode 138. What's in the box? 3, 2, 1.
I should have seen that coming.
Paltrow should have seen it coming too.
So, Matt, maybe this will get us in the mood. This is going to be kind of a stripped-down episode, but in your real-life travels, real places, real situations, don't tell me any stories here, where is the scariest place you've ever been? Like, doesn't necessarily something happen to you, just gave you a feeling of unease.
That's a tough one. I've been a lot of fucked-up places.
You did a lot of wireline work. Any of that factor in?
I mean, yeah, it's probably someplace from that list. I'm going to take another chance to eternally slight Sparks, Nevada.
Anything in particular about Sparks, Nevada?
It's just a place where, like, I don't know, feels like the locals really want to, like, rake you over the coals. Feels like everybody in Sparks feels like the Harbinger from a horror movie, you know? You kids best just turn around.
I'll tell you, man, nothing lately has given me the creeps more than being out at my girlfriend's horse property in the middle of the night. Because you're out there, you're walking around, and you hear something moving, and you know there is something there, and it is likely a 600-pound animal whose eyes light up in the dark. And if it got pissed, could probably kill you. You're just trusting that they're going to hold on to their naturally lovable demeanor in the meantime, and you just... You hear them stomping around. Every now and then, one will get annoyed with the other, and they make some ungodly noise, which out in the middle of nowhere, in the pitch dark, is terrifying.
Just ask yourself, what would Mongo do?
Time for go to bed.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
I am bugged. Beyond recall.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Now, there's only two of us here tonight, and we're going to lock ourselves in my room.
Men drilling by night, underground meeting places, pagan rituals. Well, anything's possible.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is another edition of the Night Hawks podcast, a full episode for you this time. We are in the throes of, I guess, what we're going to call... Monstoberfest After Dark. For lack of anything better to call it. We kind of had some grand Monstoberfest plans, as we often do. But, you know, as we've mentioned on the show before, life has been getting in the way, so we're doing just kind of a stripped-down episode. We found a movie we both watched. We figured we'd bring it to you, give you a full episode on it. And today we are talking about the Hellraiser remake, reboot, re-something... I don't know. It's called Hellraiser. It was made in 2022 based on the Clive Barker short story that inspired the original Hellraiser back in the day. A very iconic horror series getting a reboot. Matt, how have you been?
Oh, I'm okay. It's been a stressful day at work.
Yeah, me too. Well, I'm not at work, but it's been a stressful couple of weeks. Are you feeling the pumpkin juice flowing at all, or are you feeling particularly Halloween festive?
I like Halloween in theory. It's always a really ragged time of the year for me. I don't know why. So I always kind of like, I look up and I'm like, oh, it's the 28th. I didn't order anything. I'm going to have to go as serial killer Ed Kemper again.
You could do Gacy.
It's an easy costume for me. I just need some old glasses. If I was going to do Gacy, I would just be a regular unbranded evil clown. Gacy was such a dork anyway. I mean, not that Kemper is not, but most of those guys are dorks. We've covered this before. I did get a furry co-producer. I'm joined today. It's the inaugural podcast for the podcat, Bo.
Oh, Bo! We have a new podcat.
Who I acquired.
Yeah. I love Bo.
We're not getting along that well. I keep asking him who is a good boy, and he keeps just staring at me like he doesn't speak American.
Well, we can't have that.
So we have not established who is a good boy.
It's up in the air, Matt. It could be you.
Could be.
All right. Well, Matt, let's just jump right into it. Get us to bed at a reasonable late hour, because this is the Nighthawks podcast. We are a cinema-centric podcast for folks who like to stay up late. However,
sometimes it's Monday and we get tired.
We're not as young as and spry as we used to be back in 2015, 16. When did we start this podcast? Jesus. But anyways, I'm actually pretty pleased to be talking about, now we haven't discussed the original Hellraiser, and we're hoping maybe if the cards fall where they may and they fall in our favor, we may have a deeper discussion about Hellraiser later on for you. But today we're talking about the remake from director David Bruckner.
David Bruckner, director of such films as?
David Bruckner, who we have discussed on the show before, had a segment in The Signal. He also had a segment in VHS. He had a segment in Southbound. We're actually pretty big fans of this guy and his little cadre of filmmakers. So I was pretty excited about this. Matt, what was your first exposure to Hellraiser?
When I was a wee lad, Hellraiser was one of the most hardcore things that you could convince someone to rent you from the physical video store.
Hellraiser. Beyond any terror you have imagined. A nightmare.
No.
Unlike anything you have witnessed. Is born. Because within these walls, the unholy is unleashed.
Tear your soul apart.
And I think it was one I watched on a sleepover at a friend's house. 10 or 11, way too young to watch it, certainly. It was one of the early R-rated I Dare You to Watch It movies.
So was it one that you, did you watch this in order with the first one first, the second one second, so on and so forth?
Yeah, roughly. I don't quite remember when the second one came out.
See, I goofed it. I actually went almost backwards because I caught Hellraiser 3 on premium cable 100 years ago when I was up late watching it when my parents were in bed. And I stuck with it because at that time, I had the biggest crush on Terry Farrell, who is the lead in that movie. Probably at the time was better known as Jadzia Dax on Deep Space Nine. And so I'm like, oh, it's another Terry Farrell project, and it's an R-rated movie, maybe. And I don't think she gets naked in that movie, but that gives you an idea of what kind of mind frame I was working with at the time. And then I watched Hellraiser Bloodlines, which I believe is the fourth movie in the series, and is both ghost to space sequel and a prequel. And that was a basement watch with a bunch of friends of mine. later during a Halloween evening where some buddies of mine who were going as Cenobites that year, they had Hellraiser 2 on. So I watched that. And then eventually I'm like, well, I've watched all the others, so I'm going to watch Hellraiser 1. And so I got that locked away. But it has been years since I've seen any of them. And after 4, I kind of gave up. Bloodlines was rough. And this is one of those franchises of diminishing returns.
Bloodlines has some cool design and it has some cool imagery. I don't know how it got made.
It really seems like it was a Frankenstein movie.
Hellraiser 3 was not a runaway hit that made so much money that someone was like, we should do a combination period/sci-fi sequel to this. Because Hellraiser 3, if you've never seen Hellraiser 3, it's fun in a camp way, but it is insane. It's like someone watched the first two Hellraisers, which are very occult, sticky movies about like familial violence and the black sheep of the family sleeping with your wife and weird, gross, kind of almost V.C. Andrews stuff with a more explicitly supernatural aspect, right? And then Hellraiser 3 is like somebody watched the first two and was like, how can we get some toys out of this? It was one of those we've talked about before, like something that was, you could definitely see like, oh, that Cenobite was definitely designed for the action figure market first, you know?
In Hellraiser 1, Clive Barker showed you his vision of a private hell. In Hellraiser 2, he took you on a journey inside the inferno. Now, the terror returns in mankind's final confrontation with evil. And this time, it's going to be hell on earth.
Great club. I really love it here. It's a great club.
Not quite.
Just give me the box. Ready for your close-up?
We're going to hell,
ladies first.
Relax, baby. This is better than sex.
It's so good to be back.
Clive Barker presents Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth.
As a franchise, it has an iconic look. The Cenobites and Pinhead, and we'll get into the specifics of it later, dare I say behind a spoiler curtain. But their overall look, this kind of, I think at the time it was heavily called BDSM. There are so many kind of internecine fractures and splits in that. I'm not sure what it is technically by today's standards, but it's lots of PVC, lots of leather, lots of shiny black bondage, pain-inflicting blood play types, you know, that type of look. And
there's a guy with a Marlin through his torso.
The design of them were so iconic that it ran away. Pinhead became far more popular than any of the movies in the series.
I feel like it is also one of those things where the character design itself really ran away with people's memory of the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hellraiser 1 is a very, like I said, it's a very interior movie. It's essentially a haunted house movie with a weird sort of serial killing conceit tacked onto it. The Cenobites themselves actually only appear at the very end of it, and they actually, like, I don't know why I'm trying not to spoil a you know, literally 30-year-old movie, but
aw, pod kitty.
Bo says no spoiling. But here, I will hold you like a baby for part of the podcast until my arms get tired.
Well, what I will say about the first Hellraiser, and we're talking about the one from, I think it's 1987, it's almost an art film. It's fantastically well done. The cinematography in it is very deliberate. The look in it is very deliberate. This design, it just happens to involve occult rituals, skinless people. Like, it's a horror movie, so I think it gets lumped in with a lot of horror movies, but I think as a horror movie, it's in and of itself kind of stands apart. And then as each of the progressive sequels goes, there was this push, I feel, to get Pinhead to kind of, he's up there with the slasher boys. He's up there with Freddy Krueger and Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees and Leatherface, and he was one of the slasher icons. But I have a real hard time, especially the early Hellraiser movies, calling those quote-unquote slasher movies. And I think it was that trying to shoehorn Pinhead into that role that kind of diminished the franchise. But it has been a long time since I've seen them.
The franchise is based on a book.
Well, it's a short story, isn't it?
If you want to be technical, it's a novella. The book's called The Hellbound Heart, and the Pinhead character is just called the Hell Priest. The Cenobites are ostensibly equal in station. Doug Bradley's Pinhead happened to be the one, like, he sort of had the best voice for stage and the makeup that most enabled him to speak. And so he ended up just kind of being the lead Cenobite when they have to talk to Kirstie and make a, you know, kind of a devil's bargain with her. So he did the talking and became the face of the franchise. Like, he has a very elegant speaking voice. And I rewatched the original not too long ago, and I noticed like Frank, the bad character, has, you know, is kind of a filthy pig of a guy. They linger on his dirty fingernails, and then Pinheads are like manicured, you know. There's this whole like, yeah, he's really disturbing and hyper violent and into these experiences from, what does he call them, the outer reaches of sensation or whatever. But he's also like a repressed kind of, like, he's got some factors that are pushing and pulling. He doesn't go right for the, he doesn't linger on the nipple. He circles around the chest, you know. He's like designed with a lot of class. And then 3 is where it really jumps the shark on it. 3 is where they really try to have him be a little more like Freddy. And the Cenobites are a little more comical, and they ran with the conceit of whatever. Oh, what does this guy do in life? We're going to make him that kind of Cenobite. He's going to be a construction Cenobite. Look at this guy. He's a retail Cenobite. He's half sweater. you'll never leave Old Navy if you tangle with him, you know.
So by and large, the Hellraiser franchise concerns the Cenobites, who are our big bad. And I think in some of the movies, they are kind of confirmed in a weird political sense with a hell pantheon. And in other ways, they are also implied to be kind of extra dimensional and outside of human conception or knowledge. But the bridge that allows them to travel from wherever they're from to wherever we are and raise all kinds of hell, see what I did there, is a puzzle box, essentially Pandora's box with a puzzle element to it, where an unsuspecting person opens it and then they are victim of the Cenobites. And they can pass the curse along, or they can, you know, keep it with themselves. It works different, a little different in every movie. But that's the long and the short of it. They're these interdimensional travelers who have transcended human conception of experience and sensation. They've felt and experienced things to the nth degree beyond whatever humans can conceive of, and will offer you that opportunity, but it may not necessarily be something that you're all that keen for. This is another one where we kind of explained the rules in the first movie, but we really didn't explain the world, and each subsequent sequel kind of built more into their backstory, some more effective than others. But it's safe to say that this franchise really got bogged down.
It's sort of like, you know, the intended mythos is that, like, you're an occultist. You hear these whispers of an artifact that can grant you an incredible transcendent initiatory experience and summons beings that can take you further into this and that ecstasy and excess than you've ever gone before. And then when you summon them, it's a monkey's paw. They've done and gone through so many things themselves that they're very, 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 very twisted. And their first degree black belt that represents the mere beginning of mastery is, you know, like a S&M encounter that is far beyond a human ability to endure. And so the person gets torn apart, transported to another dimension where they can keep working on you in soul form until you essentially end up as one of them over a period of time that can take, you know, minutes or years depending on your proclivities and the needs of the plot. And the problem is they just get, like, in the middle of the series, they just get really, really bogged down, where you can tell some of them are just like, maybe grab from the slush pile, like, oh, we could just change. This is a deal with the devil movie. We could just change the devil to the Pinhead. And that kind of thing started happening with them. A couple of them were tolerable, but I would say of everyone past the first and second one, I will say that the retitled Hellraiser 2022 is the best.
Beautiful, isn't it?
It's really nice.
You can hold it.
What is it?
It's a puzzle.
And it's almost finished.
Keep going.
So if I solve it, do I get a prize?
I do.
What's your deal?
It has six sides, six configurations.
It opens up. And it cuts you.
And then they come to collect.
It's time. Greater delights await. We wish to see you proceed. Feed it. Their blood. Their pain. All for us. What is it you pray for?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this on one of our What Have We Been Watching episodes when we talked about the most recent Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I believe is just titled Texas Chainsaw. I don't even know anymore. But it was one of those things where it's like, I watched it and I'm like, hey, that was not the first movie. It wasn't as good as the first. And it wasn't even as good as the second. But man, it was better than a lot of the sequels that came after that. And I think I'm largely in the same boat with this. But that does bring us to our 2022 remake, reboot, and I think at one point Clive Barker even called this just a retooling. And I think that's fairly apt. This is not necessarily taking any plot points or any story from any of the pre-existing films. Although there are aspects to it that borrow here and there, but really it's a standalone movie that would work well in franchise, but I think because this franchise has gotten so bogged down and wandered from its origins, I think a soft reboot like this was pretty well called for, and I think they handled it well. There were definitely some changes made. There's a difference to the look, the feel, even the overall story and how it works. And so I'm remiss because I want to say that this is a good movie. Like, if this is your first exposure to Hellraiser, this will treat you well. If you're a fan of Hellraiser, this should treat you well. But if you're a super fan of Hellraiser, if you are into all of the expanded canon and all of the sequels and stuff, I don't know how this one's going to leave you. But there are definitely some superficial changes that have been made here that we should probably talk about. First and foremost is that we've done a gender swap on Pinhead. We've got Jamie Clayton taking over the role. I believe she is actually credited as the priest, which is the name of the character in the short story. I don't think Clive Barker was even particularly a fan of the Pinhead moniker, but that was probably the most front-facing change that they made, and of course, caught some pushback from different areas of fandom, and I think it was misplaced. Like, I watched this, and it's fine. Like, as far as Pinhead goes, Pinhead served Pinhead's role. And I don't think the overall exterior sex identification of the character really enters into the story at all. Even to the point where I think some of the other Cenobites looked almost kind of neuter or asexual.
Yeah, the new one is actually more consistent with the design in the book, who he identified, the speaker identifies as being actually of being so mutilated that their gender is indiscernible. And the Cenobites in the book are probably a little too extreme to be brought. Like, there'd be wholly practical effects. There wouldn't be a person really in the middle. They're pretty far gone in the book. Clive Barker writes really weird stuff. If you've never read any of it, it's pretty good, but it makes you feel bad. It feels bad, man.
Yeah, it's an uneasy read.
I don't know. It's a weird mix of like a It's like if Robert Block and Neil Gaiman worked on a book together, you'd have Clive Barker.
That's
almost a magicka to a T.
Yeah, that's really good.
Geeks, nerds, devotees of all worlds, lend me your ears. A community of inclusion and passion awaits you at oneofus.net. Movie and music reviews, debates on books and beer, deep dives into comics and games. There's something for everyone because everyone loves something. Podcast posts daily with subscriptions. You get video content as well. All are welcome because in this world of fandom and fanaticism, all of us are in this together. Your love of pop culture and entertainment makes you one of us already. So join us today at oneofus.net.
Hey everybody, I'm Alan Barber.
And I'm Kirk Klinger.
And we are the hosts of a podcast called You've Never Heard This.
You've Never Heard This?
You've Never Heard This. It's been brought to our attention by the wonderful hosts of the Nighthawks podcast that we use the word new in our promo that they so graciously play on every episode.
And we are not new, Alan.
We are not new. We are no spring chickens.
We're not.
We've been doing this a while.
We've been around. Doesn't mean we know what we're doing.
No, not at all. But we certainly like to pretend.
We try.
If you love music, then yes, you'll love this podcast. It's like a book club, except you don't have to do the homework.
Absolutely.
And we hope that you will join us talking about everything from Soundgarden to Billie Eilish to the Dresden Dolls to Korn.
Little of everything, really.
Little bit of everything.
We have fun.
We do. We have a good time. So we hope that you will join us. Enjoy our podcast. We can be found on just about every platform you can think of. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, most recently, Amazon Music and Audible.
Nice.
You have no excuse to not find us.
Yes. So you've never heard us.
Every Tuesday.
So check out
the podcast.
You've never heard this.
Enjoy.
I liked the basic plot of this one quite a bit. Like the core conceit is and it brings in a little mythology that's sort of from the HEU, the Hellraiser Extended Universe, because we see the puzzle box that summons the Cenobites or makes contact with them has different configurations. Each one requires a murder. When you have completed the last murder and move the box to the final configuration, you are offered a meeting with Leviathan, the power that of which the Cenobites are priests, right? The hell priest must be a priest of something. And the Leviathan is just this ominous presence that drops from the sky. And it was seen canonically in Hellraiser 2 and a few makes little snippet appearances in a few of the other ones. So it's the sort of power, and then it will grant you a boon, and the boons are selected essentially from a menu that correspond to the configurations, and they're things like power, sensory experience, resurrection, etc., and so forth. And we see what happens with more than one of the configurations, I'll put it that way, and they are incredibly barbed. You know, you have to be ready for their aesthetic and to be on their level. And if you're not, they only grant the technical word of what you've asked for. So we see quite a bit of sort of extension of the mythos, and we see some more Cenobites in more detail than we've seen in most of the movies. And they were cool. Some of them have pretty creepy designs. The one with its lungs on the outside was upsetting.
One of the differences between Hellraiser original flavor and then new Hellraiser, is that whereas Hellraiser was kind of BDSM, this one almost feels more like the Cenobites are something out of a Body Works display. They look more artistically inspired, like they were created to be aesthetically disturbing. There's lots of flayed flesh being used as clothing. You know, they split their sternum and peel the skin back to cover their breasts, that type of thing. And it's strangely beautiful, but also very disturbing. And the implications of it, of course, are terrifying. But that almost artistic style for them, that they look like pieces of art. And I think that really lends itself well to the themes they chose to explore in this particular edition of the story.
I like that. And because it's also become like a little less, you know, it's a little more gosh now to just be a BDSM tourist. And some of those movies haven't aged well.
Yeah. It's like, oh, look at the crazy sex people in their black leather.
Yeah. Like if you watch, was it Strangeland with Dee Snider that we thought was very extreme when it came out. And now you're just like, oh, that's not what those nightclubs are really like.
So by way of synopsis, and I guess we can do this a little pre-spoiler, is that our protagonist is Riley, played by Odessa Ezion. And she is a recovering drug addict. She's working through recovery with a boyfriend who is also in recovery. And through some machinations, stumble onto this puzzle box and start to unlock the different configurations of this puzzle box, which releases our Hellraiser baddies into the world. Number one, she has to figure out what's going on, and number two, she then has to deal with it. Parts of this, and I want to say this carefully because it could be misconstrued, but one of the major things that I thought while watching this, I'm like, huh, this kind of reminds me of the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, because there's a lot of investigation going on. Now, why I say I have to be careful with that is a lot of people don't like the Nightmare on Elm Street remake. We had our opinions on it. We have a full episode on it. You can listen to us digress there. But I do have to say the Scooby-Doo investigation angle on it is something out of that movie that I did enjoy. And so watching it come here was really satisfying. But what I will say is that this movie takes a while doing that, setting up the world, explaining the rules, and getting our protagonist up to speed, that things, horror movie things, don't really start happening until the back hour of the film.
I mean, we do see some stuff go down, but it all almost sort of happens referentially. They really hold back the thunder till they see the whites of our eyes on this one. And that may have been a pacing failing, you know, taken in aggregate. I do like that we have a big enough cast that we get some kills. It's not one of those three murder movies. I hate that. I do think, no, that's a spoiler note. I'll give that note in the spoilers.
Okay.
It's a very imposing movie. It expands the metaphor and mythos of the series. Some very cool set design, some very cool creature design. And everybody mostly played their parts well, carried what water they were given in their bucket. And it throws you some nice little curveballs, and that's why we're being a little bit spoilery about it.
Yeah.
I will say this, like, I'm not a person that actually doesn't watch these movies and romanticizes them because they like Pinhead. I've seen the other 10 movies more than once, and believe me, third best Hellraiser movie in the 11 movie franchise is not actually that hard, right? And then fourth is a tie between Bloodlines and Deader, number I want to say 7. And then the last two are the most recent two that were made off license when the license lapsed and don't have Doug Bradley in them. And they're real trash. They're essentially, what do we want to do, dude? Do you want to make like a 90-minute Tool video or a Hellraiser movie with some real vague imagery in it and a lot of filters to hide that we didn't do anything really? Why don't we do both? Why don't we just mix those concepts and not have any Tool music? Like that's number 9 and 10. They're real bad. They're stinkers. My personal one that I have a soft spot for in my heart is Hellworld. Remember like a certain time and place when a lot of little VR movies were coming out?
Mm-hmm.
Like Brain Scan and The 13th Floor and stuff like that.
Lawnmower Man, that type of thing?
Yeah, it's one of those from that era, but a Hellraiser. It's a big old beautiful swing, man. But I think it holds up well in the series. It's consistent with the series. It is. They understood the assignment. My concern is that the so many years of Halloween costumes and side projects and cosplays and stuff have sort of muddied the assignment in the minds of the audience.
I think that's fair. And I think this movie actually straddles a pretty good line about evoking certain moments from slasher movies and things like that. Like this feels like a slasher movie in a couple of places, but isn't. Like, it never fully commits to it, and I think it's to the movie's betterment.
Well,
but it does have that fun, watch it on a Halloween party evening kind of here come the kills, here comes the violence aspect to it. Once you get to that back half.
And one thing I've always liked about the puzzle box device, this is very natural to pick something up and fidget with it. And it's also like when you look at it, it kind of looks expensive and interesting. And then when parts of it move, you would keep playing with it. It's not something where you go, no, like, don't get me wrong. I went to Barbarian recently and I did like it, but it has some moments of intense, like no sane human being would go into that dark alley, right?
Right.
And finding and opening the box seems very natural. So I've always liked that device. It doesn't seem like something where half the people in the audience would jump out of their seats and go, don't pick that up. Don't do that.
All right. Well, I think personally, this movie it hit me. I do have to say, I don't have a ton of love for the Hellraiser franchise going into this. I like the Hellraiser franchise. The first one is like I said, almost a piece of art. But as far as a franchise goes, this is not one that I held near and dear to me. So monkeying with the way things look, monkeying with the world, monkeying with the way the box works and how that, none of that really bothers me. I'm ready for a new configuration of Hellraiser. And I think this delivered. It gave me the Spielkus. It had some good thematic work here, which we'll talk about beyond the spoiler curtain. The performances were pretty on time. The violence was brutal. The implications were terrifying. It's just it Hellraiser movie advertised, Hellraiser movie delivered. I don't know what else you want from this franchise, but this one delivered for me, and I am going to give it a recommendation based on that.
Yeah, same. I would give it, you know, like a solid 83 out of 100 headpins.
All right, Matt. Well, do you want to...
I want to open the spoiler box?
Open the spoiler box? Yeah. Matt, post-spoiler curtain. The original Hellraiser really left me with a story that I felt was about corruption. It was about the bad things in our life that corrupt us, that lead us to corrupt others. I think there's an allegory there that can be read. And I think that's present here too in the Hellraiser 2022. But I think really the subtext here is not that buried. I think this is very much about substance abuse. The rewards that we get for getting high, and the cost that puts on our loved ones and our friends, and is that fair, and how do we manage that? And it's pretty on display there, but I think it's deftly handled, and I really enjoyed kind of following the bouncing ball through this movie. How about you?
I think it wears that on its sleeve, and that's very there. I do think it has a slight flaw in that they couldn't quite make themselves go, okay, the Cenobites are bad. They hurt people. They got into the trap of making them like too, like in D&D terms, they are devils when they need to be more fiends a little bit, because they got very caught up in the idea that they're lawful and they have to obey certain banes and prohibitions and act only according to this ritual that's laid out, and under certain circumstances they hold off or bargain or can't be attacked. And like in the original, Pinhead essentially just makes a handshake deal with Kirstie. She says, she opens the box, and he says, it doesn't matter that you open it by accident. It doesn't matter. Intent doesn't matter. The world's not fair. You opened it. We came, and now we get to play with you. And she throws her Uncle Frank, who introduced the box to the situation and is currently in an undead state, having escaped the Cenobites, unbeknownst to them while they were pursuing other things. She says, I can give you my Uncle Frank. He's back in the real world. He's back on Earth. He's slowly restoring himself to life. And the Pinhead, the head Cenobite, says, well, no one has ever escaped us. That can't be true. But if you can prove what you're saying. And she's like, no, it's true. You're wrong. And sort of in the form of saying, like, I'm never wrong. I'll eat my hat if he's on this plane. He says, well, if you prove what you're saying, maybe we can discuss letting you go and taking him instead, right? But it's not like binding. It's not like she signed it. It's not the devil and Daniel Webster situation. And the new one a little more is, which is, I thought it was interesting. Unspoiler alert, right? The spoiled synopsis is that the boyfriend takes Riley to steal something. They're going to steal it and have a big score and have a bunch of money and be able to live independently without their various patronages. And it turns out to be this puzzle box. There's nothing in the shipping container except a safe that has the box in it. And I will say there is a little a thing I raised my eye at that turned out to not be a mistake, which is that it's way too easy for them to get in the safe. Right, the guy basically just hits it with a crowbar and gets the box out.
Right.
Well, so, and they start messing around with the box. When you solve the box, right, a little booby trap blade shoots out of it and it cuts your hand, and that makes a blood sacrifice. Well, she happens to like miss herself with the booby trapped blade, and then she cuts someone else with it in the course of like the just messing around with this thing. She's like, look, a little knife pops out of it if you do this. And sacrifices them instead. And so they realize that more stuff yet can happen with this thing if you work through it carefully. You don't have to be the sacrificial lamb. You can use the box to sacrifice a third party and feed it that way and get all the way through this 5-stage ritual that they eventually figure out is associated with it, right? And they do some forensic investigation on its provenance and the identity of the guy they ripped it off from, and they end up at his abandoned house in the countryside, which has been outfitted with all this grating and cladding and scaffolding that mimics the structure of the box. And lo and behold, it's a big giant devil's trap to use in the final stage of the process when you bargain with the Leviathan when it appears.
What are you?
Explorers in the further regions of experience. Of sensations, Rim. Our gifts are boundless.
I don't want them.
Yes, you do. Our God awaits. You know what it can offer.
Resurrection.
Your brother's ending was exquisite.
What?
Would it bring you comfort to see him again? Two more, and he is yours. Feed it. Their pain. Their blood. Unlock the next configuration. And then the last.
No. I've done enough.
Enough is a myth.
Then we get spoiler upon spoiler within spoiler. She gets through it. They do the ritual. They summon the Cenobites. Their friends are there, minus a few that get picked off along the way. And they're like, holy shit, what are these things that are standing outside? And there's very good like nightmare energy sequences where the Cenobites are kind of herding them into the house. A few assorted things like that go down. And then they use the mechanisms that the owner installed in the house to create a standoff and try to bargain with them. And then it turns out that the original owner who completed the ritual and disappeared is alive, and he's inside the walls of the house, and he chose the liminal configuration of the 5 box configurations that you can pick from, which is the one for unending, incredible sensation. And so he's been afflicted with a machine that causes periodic, intense pain by actually kind of, there's no need to even unspoil that, but it's bad, right? Although the effect itself is a little comical. It kind of reminded me of the classic arrow through the head, you know? But And so the next reveal yet, which is that the boyfriend is in his employ, and the entire idea was to go to 12 step and find some disposable people to feed to the box. But he actually does kind of like this girl, and he's conflicted and tortured, but then he does the bad stuff anyway, and she figures it out and ends up giving him to the box, and they get to the final stage and they open it, and ultimately she chooses to not wish, right? And all through the Hellraiser series, the unopened box, when you find it, has been referred to as the lament configuration. Like lament, lamenters, lamenting something.
Lamentation, yeah.
Regretting, in other words. The Hell Priest gets disgusted with her and says, your punishment, the thing we inflict on people that choose the lament configuration, is that forever you will know that there's a supernatural world and you could have had an incredible, unique experience within it, and you're not ever going to have that. It will never work for you again. You've denied us, and now we deny you. So your configuration is the lament. And then ostensibly they let her go. That was, I thought, nicely poetic and loop closing and a good little denouement. It does have the flaw of it assumes you understand that reference, and that you go, oh, that's why it's called that. That makes sense now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a little bit, one place I landed on this is it does have a lot of fan service and a lot of things that like are clearly there for you to get, like Pinhead almost says a couple of Pinhead's lines.
She has one dead lift.
Yeah. Well, it's actually not quite. I just watched Hellraiser 1 and she says, I think she says explorers from the furthest reach of sense and sensation.
Oh, I was talking about we have such sights to show you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, there is that one. But and a couple of the other ones are very close. Like, they're the same meter, but not quite the same line. I didn't mind that, but if this is your step-in point, you're going to be like, why did the movie kind of stop while Bart said the line, you know?
Yeah.
And I think there's a big failing here in the fact that all this work was put into the design of the Cenobites, and then fundamentally in action, they're just really creepy people. Although one of them, like, when they get a hold of someone they've been, that's been marked that they're allowed to sacrifice, then they can do magic on that person, right? They summon chains to tear them apart or wires to cut them to pieces or et cetera, right? But when they're just like chasing everybody through the mansion and it turns into 13 ghosts for about 20 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
They handle one of them exactly like you'd handle a big guy. They just sort of like lock him into a thing and he can't get out of it. And you're kind of like, huh, I thought he'd have something for that. He looks like he'd have something for that. He looks like he'd been locked in a cage before, you know? But other than like, it had the Blade 2 syndrome where like, there's so much history and design and these are so interesting. And then they don't functionally differ that much from if someone had just hired a, you know, 250 pound guy to assault them.
Right.
Joker hiring a Joker thug to beat them up would have been functionally the same for the plot. They don't do anything terribly unique unless you've been marked by the box. And one thing I actually thought was cool, and I had to kind of look at it twice, and I'm not 100%, but there are more Cenobites in the end than the beginning, and I think they're the victims. Like one of them, I think, is clearly Nora, the girl that dies in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them looks like she's the older woman. But they don't like show that and lampshade it and be like, this is the conversion process. And now Sarah and Nora are the princess and the duck or whatever, you know. I'd like to see a duck-based Cenobite. Little bills everywhere. This is a no-sleep concept. But no, I was very satisfied with it. I think it's a good launching point. Like, it'll be a good re-anchoring of the series. I think the property is back in the hands of the people that ought to own it. Doug Bradley was missed, although some odd things were done with his Pinhead in canon. And they've kind of said it, well, it would be, like, you know, given what happens in Hellraiser 3 and 4, it'd be kind of weird to bring him back. They had to work around that in some of the later ones. And he was like, oh, you may have heard a rumor that I was a human and at one point, and when somebody found that out, they used it to manipulate me and get me to admit remorse and blah, blah, blah. And then I was stripped from my powers for
showing weakness, but that's not true. This is Hellraiser 6, and I just show up and do cool shit. You know? And so they were like, well, we didn't want that effect. We wanted a clean break. Doug will always be Pinhead in a certain sense, and he didn't fight the transition very hard. He gave the new cast his blessing.
And actually I'm sure sang some pretty good praises of the design on Twitter not too long ago.
Like, if you want to get into the drama, he was a little shitty about it when they started pre-production. He was like, oh, they're because of the two corpse fuckings that occurred before it. The other two without him are not good. They're excrement. They're not worth your time. I hesitate to call them cash-ins because I think the dudes that made them generally genuinely like the license. But you could just tell it was made by like some metalheads that were passing a Jeffrey at about 3 a.m. and went, oh no, he's made a Hellraiser in a while. I inherited some money from my great uncle Hubert, and why don't we check and see if that license is for sale? You know, they're just messy. They're just big messes. I think they turned everybody like all the people that are associated with the quote unquote good Hellraisers off of working on it again. And so there was a little bit of a like, oh great, when this first started pre-production, and then Hulu picked it up and it got some money behind it and they started to see the design was going to be good. And after they let Doug Bradley watch it, he was like, yeah, it was pretty good. Fair enough. You know?
Yeah.
And Doug Bradley's not hurting for work. So don't cry for him. You know, there's somebody else will need a tall, skinny guy in a rubber suit before long, you know?
Well, and that's the thing about Pinhead though, is that especially for those first couple of movies, he's really almost a force of nature more than he's a character. And that's no shade on Doug Bradley as an actor or a performer or his performances. He has a presence that is unique and is brought by him, but he's a presence more than he is a character. He's not a fully fleshed out being that has wants and desires and motivations and subtext and stuff. Like, he's really there to be scary and hurt people. And he does a great job of it. He does better than I think most people would, but that is that character. And I think being able to slip another actor into that role is not a huge deal, and I think they did fantastic with it. It's a great design. I will say that there's nothing in this movie that you haven't seen before in other movies. Even the whole subtext of drug abuse and the way that works. I mean, that was what, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 or 4? Where Freddy is manifesting as their different addictions. I mean, there's things like that out there, and I think that's why ultimately this didn't just nail my hair to the wall. I didn't see anything new here that I haven't seen before. But I did see it done well. I saw it done skillfully. It looks good. It feels good. This doesn't quite have that. Like, when I first watched Hellraiser, it almost had a tinge of the forbidden for me. And maybe that's, you know, I was young. I was a young Catholic kid. This is definitely playing in some satanic imagery in some of the sequels. Like, it felt weird and scary and intense and like nothing I had ever seen before. This doesn't have that. I have seen all of this before, but it is done really well, and I did not have a single complaint for my ticket. I'm not sure what Trevor's whole buy-in here was. Like, at some point, I just feel like that guy would bounce. But I don't know. It could easily be explained away with a scene that doesn't appear in the movie, and it would be fine. It's just that scene isn't in the movie. Or maybe I missed it. I don't know.
I think he's kind of the industrialist dude's, the reclusive dude. I think he's kind of his apprentice. Like, I think he's meant to think he gets in on the power granted at the end. Sure. By the big wish.
But when you're in the grand hall with the Leviathan over you, and you know, you're learning that everything that they grant is a monkey's paw, I don't know that I'm going to go chase the guy down. I don't know.
Well, that also does bring me to like what, in my opinion, is sort of the structural and narrative failing of this franchise generally. It doesn't actually do that good of job of explaining what the dark, sticky things that the Cenobites do to and with you are, right? Like, so we don't see like, oh, this guy is into hermeticism and he's a member of the Society of the Golden Dawn and he gets into ritual magic and chaos magic and tantric magic, and it's not good enough anymore, and he needs to go further and like kill a puppy to light a candle across the room, and shit starts getting weirder and keeps getting weirder. And so it's not really all the occult stuff in the Hellraiser movies, mostly actually happens off screen. It's that like Frank is the guy that is illuminated. He's the twisted seeker, and all of his twisted seeking happens before the actual movie Hellraiser starts. It happens off stage while he's away from the family. Hellraiser 1 is really just dealing with the consequences of his actions, not showing the actions. And I think this one does that too, and it doesn't make it clear. Like I think if they showed like a couple different attempts at this ritual, and eventually the attempter succumbs or whatever, and they show that this billionaire guy, that he sort of paid people to do the hard parts for him and sacrificed other people instead of himself and put other people through the trials and not himself, and then snatched the box out of their hand at the end when they were dead and it was solved. And that's why he isn't ready for what he gets. And that's why he gets the most ironic version of it. And that's why he's, again, not ready at the end when he tries to do it a second time.
Oh, what is that? Oh, what the fuck is happening? Isn't it obvious? I claimed my reward.
I have experienced everything afforded to man, and still, I wanted more. I chose Liminal. I chose sensation. But the Cenobites, their tastes were not what I imagined. They preyed on my nerves, pulling them in random cycles, stopping just enough so I could never grow numb.
What they do to him is so awful, he tries to get another wish to undo it. So he's highly motivated to complete the ritual a second time, but he still doesn't do it himself. He still tricks other people into doing the magic for him.
And I think that brings me to my final point, which is the lamentation configuration, which is what our protagonist is stuck with at the end, is not only is it you have this grand opportunity that we are never going to give you again, it's also you went through all that shit to get here. You sacrificed 5 people to get here. Their blood is on your hands. And when it came time to get what you were supposed to get with that, you didn't take it. And you will always have that regret. And once again, I think it's really easy to kind of overlay the addiction analogy there. You've stolen from your family. You've alienated yourself from your friends. You've done all this chasing this high. As you enter recovery, you are stuck with the fact that now the thing that you did that for is no longer in play. And you have to go and start picking up those pieces. And I just... Like I said, it's not a particularly subtextual or embedded analogy, but I think it's just really deftly handled, and I really liked just kind of following that evolution throughout the movie.
Yeah. I think as that analogy, the movie works really well because the Cenobites are kind of the addiction, going like, let's go all the way. Let's go all the way. Let's do one last shot and not wake up, right?
I'm going to revisit our old Monstoberfest remake kind of set of criteria that we talked about. Was this faithful to the source material? Is that working for or against it? Is it doing enough of its own thing? Is it a worthy remake of the original? Is it better than the original? And is it a good stand by itself property? I'd say it's faithful enough to the original film. I haven't read the short story, but like, this is recognizably a Hellraiser movie. It plays by the Hellraiser rules, certain versions, certain incarnations of that. I think most of the changes are working in favor of this movie. It's not trying to be the original. It's doing its own thing, but it's evoking the original. I think they struck a pretty good balance there. I think this is a worthy remake of the original. I think the spirit of what these things are and what this franchise is alive and well in this version. I don't think it's better than the original by any definition, but it is a pretty good standalone. I think you said a good jumping off point for somebody who's interested in the franchise.
It's a good regrouping. I think it's very faithful to source material, probably even more so than the original script in terms of being faithful to the novella.
Mm-hmm.
I'm anxious to see them make another one.
I agree. I'd really like to see this team take another stab at this franchise. And in that grand question we ask ourselves, should it be sequelized? Should it be remade? This is the remake, but I think a sequel to the remake is pretty in order. I think this is all right, and this franchise is in good hands.
I love to imagine the producer of 9 and 10 out there just like, oh, they didn't understand my art. They made another Workaday movie or... there's a linear story.
All right. Well, I think that's about going to wrap it up for me. Folks, find us on Facebook. Find us on the podcatcher of your choosing. We are on Amazon, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, the whole nine yards. If we are not somewhere that you'd like to find us, let us know. But otherwise, we're pretty well out there. Be sure to find us on Twitter and Instagram. And in the meantime, hope you have a happy spooky season. And if we've got another episode in us, we will try and get that for you. But again, we're still trying to navigate the difficulties of life. And this is what we can guarantee you. We brought you this episode. If there's more, we'll bring that to you too. If there's not, we'll catch you next Halloween.
It's almost Halloween, so go get some full-size Snickers.
Hell yeah. Give me a king-size Reese's cup. That's the good house.
And if you're that lady that gives pennies, oh, it's on. What are you waiting for? What do you think you were created for? So we should care. So we should dare. You don't know what happened, but if you weren't there. Born to raise hell. Born to raise hell. The cat has decided the most alluring place in the apartment is right where my wrist rest would be if I had one. And then every time he hops up there, I pick him up, but I can't bear to just like shoo him off it. So I just hold him like a little baby, and he gets tension, and then he does it again. And I don't know what I'm going to do about it because I can barely bear to be mean to him at all.
Oh,
I don't know. I just have to deal with this creature now that is angel to some, kitty to others.
The finest temptation is touching those toe beans.
He is totally permissive, dude. He has no, he lets you just you can pick him up upside down like a baby and pet his tummy for as long as you want.
Oh, I want this.
He's a devilish little guy.
Hey, this is TC.
And this is Jim from the Studio Demands It podcast.
Where every episode we take a demand from a hypothetical studio.
Which could be you.
And challenge ourselves to conceptualize, pitch, and craft a film based on the stipulations.
Or the demands.
We are given. We talk about movies all the time. Particularly, we complain about the choices made in the films we've seen.
We're nerds like that.
And, of course, like any good nerd does, we automatically assume... we could do better.
Even with the demands and restrictions that clearly must have been put on by a production.
So head on over to StudioDemandsIt.com and listen to our previous library of episodes. Damn it. Our library of previous episodes. Our precious library, Jim. Our library of precious episodes.
You're a pirate, Smeagol.
Okay. So head on over to StudioDemandsIt.com to listen to our library of episodes.
And submit your demand for a future episode, too.
So go do that.
Okay, bye.
Okay, end of ad.